He was a middle-aged man, and he had a podcast, and the podcast was about books, and the books were from high school, and there had been 9 episodes so far, but none of them had featured the old man in the sea. Welcome back to Sophomore Lit. Do you like us? Yes or no, check one. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me today is guest host Erica Ensign. Did I pronounce that right?
You're close. It's Ensign.
Ensign. Okay, Erica Ensign. This is my first time talking with Erica. We were introduced via John Siracusa, who is quite frequently a guest on Jason Snell's Incomparable podcast. And the Incomparable, back in episode 246, did an episode on assigned reading. And John suggested we get together and continue our discussion of high school reading. So tell us about yourself, Erica.
Well, I am definitely a reader, so that made me perfect for that episode of The Incomparable, as well as this podcast. However, I had not had the chance to go back and reread any of my high school stuff until this, so that's kind of an interesting thing. Other than reading, I do an awful lot of podcasting. In addition to being a frequent guest on The Incomparable, like John Siracusa, I also have my own podcast on their network, Lazy Doctor Who, where I talk about Doctor Who with my husband. And I also play Dungeons and Dragons live on the internet on The Incomparable Network on the Total Party Kill podcast. My main podcast is called Verity, which is another Doctor Who podcast, me and 5 other women from across the globe talking about Doctor Who. And I also co-host the Audio Guide to Babylon 5. Because it doesn't matter if a show has been off the air for 20 years, if it's geeky enough, I will keep talking about it. And last but not least, I produce a short fiction podcast for The Uncanny Magazine. So I'm all over the board in podcast land.
This time we are going to discuss The Old Man in the Sea, which is the answer to a lot of trivia questions of what is a title with 6 three-letter words. I remember this pretty well from my high school days because I remember the class complaining very loudly about this book. All the kids in my class hated this book. They hated the old man. They didn't understand him. They didn't know why he was talking to himself. And mostly they didn't understand why he kept talking to the fish and why he claimed to love the fish when he was just going to beat it over the head.
You know, we touched on this briefly when we did that episode of The Incomparable, and at the time, I had different categories. I had the books that I hated, the books that I really loved, and the books that were just kind of meh in the middle. And on my list at that time, this was firmly in the middle because I didn't have strong recollections one way or the other. But going back and rereading it in preparation to talk about it here, and also sort of digging through some of my stuff I had left over from high school, I'm realizing that I actually liked it better than I had remembered. I actually wrote a couple of poems for an assignment about The Old Man in the Sea, and I don't think I would have done that if I would have hated it as much as my classmates did. But like you, I remember classmates hating this book and complaining very loudly about it for the same reasons that you mentioned.
Well, it was a very short book, so I don't know what they were complaining about there.
Yeah.
This is, of course, by Ernest Hemingway, one of the most famous American authors of the 20th century, who is another Midwesterner. I've noticed a lot of the people that I read in high school had origins in the Midwest. Ernest Hemingway was born in Oak Park, Illinois in 1899. And in World War I, he was an ambulance driver. He got wounded during that war. And while recuperating, he fell in love with his nurse. But his nurse eventually dumped him for an Italian soldier. And people who like to psychologize about these things think that this led to a general misogyny on Hemingway's part. He worked after World War I as a reporter in Toronto and Chicago, and eventually he became a foreign correspondent in Paris, where he met up with Gertrude Stein and Ezra Pound. And Gertrude Stein, I think more than anyone, affected young Hemingway in his style.
When we studied the book, we did not talk about Hemingway himself very much at all. So the things that I know about him as a writer are really the sorts of things that you glean through just, you know, kind of being a literate person. And I never actually read any biographies or in-depth articles about him. I just kind of know the basics that most people would know.
Well, have you ever read any Gertrude Stein?
Not at all.
If you like what Hemingway is on about in his style, Stein is like that times 100. She writes these incredibly repetitive stream of consciousness stories that have absolutely no plot whatsoever. And so if you're into that sort of thing, God love you. Go check out Three Lives by Gertrude Stein. But Stein, in turn, was influenced by not Henry James, but William James, his brother, and the philosophy of phenomenology. There was a lot of emphasis in Stein's work on the present as it is experienced in the moment. And that, I think, is what Hemingway came away from his relationship with Stein with. Now, he ended up coming back to America, writing his first great novel, The Sun Also Rises, in 1926. He wrote several more novels in the late 20s and early 30s. And in the 30s, he was a reporter on the Spanish Civil War. So he saw a lot of combat. But by the time he wrote this book, The Old Man and the Sea, his best days were kind of behind him. He had written several novels that had not really gone anywhere with the critics in the 50s and or the 40s and 50s. And so he was living in Cuba at the time, and this was his return to the world stage. And it got picked up by the Book of the Month Club, which cannot be underestimated as a tastemaker for that time. Every literate American subscribed to the Book of the Month Club back in those days. And it was being picked up by that was a sure sign of success. And Hemingway had a hit on his hands.
Well, one of the things that I do know about this book is that the idea for it, the seed of it, had been planted for many years before he actually got around to writing it. He had written, I don't remember if it was an interview or an article that he had written for, and I'm blanking on the magazine, but something that had come out years before, and in which he related basically the bare bones of this story that he said had been told to him by someone in Cuba. So this was something that had kind of been marinating for a long time, and he had planned, I think he even pitched it to his publisher quite a bit earlier, and then ended up getting sidetracked with something else and publishing something else instead. And then only many years later did he come back to it and write it. And as you mentioned, by this time, he was, his better days were behind him. And I wonder what kind of a different story it may have ended up being if he would have written it earlier in his career, early in his life, when he felt a little bit more vibrant. We might have ended up with a very different story than we got here when it was so much later in his career.
Sure. And I think in many ways, it's a kind of an atypical Hemingway. If you think about novels like The Sun Also Rises or A Farewell to Arms, Hemingway wrote a lot about the disappointments of romantic and sexual love, about the frustrations of being a man and of wartime. And by the time he wrote this book, the other thing I would say is this book has a lot of symbolism in it, which is not typical for Hemingway. And it was kind of funny to me because I remember in the class, the teacher really, really harping on every last damn Christian symbol in this book. Mm-hmm. And I always find that to be the most uninteresting way to read a book. It's sort of because ultimately it just asks the question of why, what for. And it's not really an allegory, I don't think, of Christ. I think it's more that this is part of Hemingway's vocabulary that he's using. So it's kind of an unusual book in Hemingway's, and it's also a short book. It's closer to his short stories in that sense. So let's talk about the plot. It's got a very very short plot. To say what happens in this book, on the one hand, very little happens in this book, and the other hand, a lot does.
Yeah, it's a sort of plot with a lowercase p.
Right. So with this, the titular old man is a man named Santiago, although his name is, I think, given maybe once in the book or twice or something like that, but he's basically called the old man throughout the book, who is an elderly fisherman, a very poor fisherman. He doesn't fish with nets. He goes out and he fishes with lines in the Gulf Sea from Cuba. He's working out of Havana, and he has, at the start of the book, we're told he's gone 84 days without catching a fish.
Yeah, that is an excessively long time. So long that he had this young boy that used to help him out, and his parents eventually said, "Nope, this dude is bad mojo. So you need to go elsewhere and fish with somebody else." So he's not only an old man who is fishing, but he's an old man who is fishing alone all the time now. And for 84 days, he's still had no luck whatsoever. And I remember reading the beginning of the book and not understanding the kind of fishing that he was doing. That was something that I sort of had to learn as a youngster, because they talked about the kid joining a new boat where they caught three fish in 3 days or something like that. And I was like, that doesn't sound like very much. So it was kind of an eye opener to recognize exactly what it means to be a fisherman of that sort. And then, of course, that made the rest of the book sort of make a little bit more sense and hit harder to think about this guy, you know, if he's fighting a regular old tuna or something, not such a big deal. Marlin? Yeah, that's a much bigger thing.
The old man spends a lot of time talking to himself in the book. He spends a lot of time obsessing over Joe DiMaggio and the New York Yankees. And he also spends a lot of time thinking about his childhood in Africa. He apparently comes from the Canary Islands, which were a Spanish colony at that time. Are they still part of Spain today? I can't remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Well, anyway, they're just off the coast of Morocco. And so he was able to visit mainland Africa and see lions. And we're told that he dreams about them all the time now. So he goes out in his boat after the boy, who is his apprentice, who is not coming along with him, nonetheless, is looking after him, taking care of his fishing equipment, making sure that he eats something before he goes out. And the old man decides he's going to go out deeper than he has before, searching for, as you say, large fish. This guy is not the kind of guy who catches a bunch of little mackerel or whatever. He catches marlin, which are enormous fish. And very difficult to manage. They're the kind of thing that today a really rich person with a huge yacht will have an enormous deep sea fishing setup and feel very proud of themselves when they land it. He's going out basically with a bunch of line that he's going to have to manipulate more or less by hand. And so he does go out deep into the Gulf, and on the 85th day of his streak, he does have the bait taken by a very large fish. He can't see the fish.
But he can feel how big it is. That's, I think, one of the ways that we're early able to recognize that he is such an experienced and solid fisherman. He knows, just based on the way that the line has been taken and how it is resting in the water, that this is a big fish, and can even sort of tell which direction the fish is moving and what it is doing down underneath him. He really knows what he's talking about. And like you said, this is not like a big old yacht with a huge rig. It's a few lines that are all hanging at different depths, and he's very proud of how straight he can keep those lines. And it's basically hanging off of a rowboat. It's kind of a skiff that's not all that big. So he's really in tune with the sea that he is on and the fish that he's trying to catch.
He is able to set the hook on this fish, and he now has to play the game of drawing the fish slowly back to the boat, letting it tire itself out. You have to not let the line become so taut that it breaks, because if the fish just takes off at any moment as fast as it can, it could snap the line. And he expects it to be something of a fight, but he doesn't realize that he's going to end up being pulled by the fish, which is what happens. He gets pulled by the fish further out to sea, and pulled basically overnight. And he starts to talk aloud to the fish and think about this fish, and he calls the fish his brother. He talks about how much he loves this fish.
Mm-hmm.
He's able to catch also off of one of the other lines a small tuna, which he brings aboard for his own food, which he's going to have to eat raw. And he sustains a few injuries. There's a point where, because he's bracing the line across his back, the strain across his back makes it start to hurt. He's pulled forward with a lurch and he hits his head on the front of the boat, and he cuts his hand at one point. And this is one of those Christ symbols that my teacher liked to point to with glee and say, "Look, look, look, it's a crucifixion symbol." And I'm not exactly sure what to make of that. I think that one does hurt one's hands while you use a line of string.
And at another point too, even before I think it's before he hurts himself, his hand, his left hand cramps up on him, so he gets like, his body is betraying him, and he comes back to that quite a lot throughout the rest of the book, talking about his left hand and how it's not as good as his right hand, and curse it for being so weak.
Right, for a book with really one character, it does have quite a bit of dialogue. The old man talks to himself, he talks to the fish, he talks to the universe in general, and he has a lot of thoughts about what he's doing. He states that he loves the fish, but he's going to have to kill the fish. He wonders aloud whether it's right to kill the fish. Then he wonders aloud whether he thinks too much about what he's doing.
I was nodding vigorously at that point.
And this is one of those things that I think, again, as a teenager, when you're a teenager, I hate to say it, you're at the least empathetic time in your life. And it's very hard, I think, for teenagers to have any patience for this kind of ambivalence about things. Teenagers like to think that the world is very black and white and they know what's right or wrong, and they figure either the old man should let the fish go or the old man should just pull the fish in and he should stop whining about it. And so I think a lot of this is kind of wasted on a high school crowd.
I think it's the rare high school student that's going to get out of this what's there to be gotten.
At one point, he decides that if he is able to bring the marlin aboard or up to kill it, he will not let anyone eat it. But then again, he goes right back to determining, thinking about aloud how big this fish is and how much he will get per pound for that. So
I think the way I took that was he decided that nobody is worthy to eat the marlin, but I think he was going to let them eat it anyway because he wanted the money for it.
he does eat his tuna. There's long discussions about how he cuts strips in the tuna. Tuna isn't a bad fish to eat raw. That's basically sushi there. But he later ca catches a small dolphin, and he has to force himself to eat a bit of that, which he claims is just nauseating him. And so, I mean, this is the other thing that this book is full of. It's full of long, excruciating passages about uncomfortable physical situations. We're treated to long descriptions of how tight the line is across his back, how much he hurts. When his hand cramps up, we get maybe 3 or 4 pages describing the cramp. So if you're not the kind of person who likes those kinds of descriptions of physical discomfort, this is also not the book for you.
Very true.
Anyway, on the third day, the fish wears itself out and starts to circle the skiff, and Santiago is able to pull it in close to the boat, and he has a harpoon which he's able to stab the marlin through. Now, the marlin is enormously big. It's like something like 12,000 pounds is what he's guessing it to be, which is
Bigger than his boat, even.
right, bigger than his boat. And he is very happy to have captured the marlin, to have killed it, and he straps it to the side of the boat because there's no way to bring it aboard. There's no way to clean it. He's just going to have to bring it back to harbor. But he's pretty far out now. He's far, so far he can't see land, but he knows where he's going.
Right. He says that when the sun is down, he'll be able to see the glow of land. So he's not even sure quite how far out he is. He's just able to, he knows that he's able to navigate based on his knowledge of the area. But when it gets to be dark, he realizes that he's even farther than he kind of thought he was.
This is not going to be a happy ending for the book. As anyone who has any sense of Hemingway knows, because on his way home, sharks start getting the scent of the marlin strapped to his boat, and first a great mako shark comes, and as it comes and takes a huge bite out of the marlin, he stabs the shark with his harpoon, but the harpoon is lost as the shark sinks under, and he starts to make makeshift weapons for himself. He takes his knife and straps it to the end of of an oar, and when more sharks come, he stabs them, but that knife snaps off. Eventually, he's left kind of defenseless, and sharks just keep coming.
I think for me, once the fish is dead, that's sort of when I, as a reader, get bored. because at that point he's fighting with the sharks, he's thinking, he's doing a lot more thinking about things, and I just don't find his thoughts interesting. I found the struggle earlier in the book a more interesting thing, man versus fish. I was sort of on the edge of my seat, so to speak, wanting to know what happened next. So the contest itself is the part of the book that sings for me. And then we shift gears and we are focusing a little bit less specifically, and maybe some high school students would appreciate this, but we are focusing less on the external contest. We don't get the line-by-line description of every single shark battle that he goes through. By the end, it's just sort of like, and then some more sharks came, and then some other sharks came, and then they ate the fish. So I think that I was in more enjoying the earlier parts where it was we were sort of seeing things happen, and it seems as the book goes on. The more he fights with the sharks, the more time he spends in his head. And he's been awake for like 3 days now, so he's getting loopier. And the loopier his thoughts get, the less I am able to stay with them and enjoy that.
Well, I would agree that one of the things that happens is the mode of this book is sort of stretching the moment out as long as the reader has patience for it. And so we're treated to a day and a half out in the boat before anything happens. And then we're treated to 2 days of him being pulled around by the fish. And at the point that the sharks show up, you kind of know how this is going to end up. Even though this book is, I think my copy of it was like 127 pages long, somewhere around page 80, you start looking ahead to see how many pages you've got left, and it does turn out to be a lost cause. The sharks are just too many, and they keep tearing chunks off the marlin. Eventually, all that he's left with is basically a big fish skeleton tied to the side of his boat. He's able to make much better time back to back to shore, and when he gets to shore, very wearily he takes his mast off the skiff, and this is again yet another one of these Christ images, because he's pulling this mast through town till he gets to his small hut and falls asleep. And the
Not
next
only does he fall asleep, he slept face down on the newspaper with his arms out straight and the palms of his hands up. So.
Sure. I will give that these symbols are here. I would say they're kind of part of the vocabulary of what Hemingway is using. I don't think that he is trying to say that Santiago is in any way a Christ figure.
No, I certainly didn't pick up on that either. And really, even I felt like religion itself kind of crept up just a little bit as the book went on. I didn't find that it was a theme that ran throughout it. Earlier in the book, we had a couple of mentions of sort of philosophy of life, superstition stuff. You know, Santiago says he isn't superstitious about turtles, but then later we find him refusing to say a good thought out loud because he knows if you say a good thing, it might not happen. So you get those kinds of philosophy kind of things earlier on. And then later in the book, as he's battling with the fish, he claims to himself out loud that he's not religious, but he offers to pray 10 Our Fathers and 20 Hail Marys or even more later on in the book. And even later than that is talking about how he's not sure if he believes in sin, and saying that he has no understanding of it. So I don't necessarily, based on the way that he's discussing religion and the way he's thinking about religion, I don't pick up on him being I don't think he's supposed to be a Christ figure. At least that's not the way that I read it. But, you know, there are a couple of moments that have that sort of symbolism in them. But I think that I feel the same way that you do, that that's more sort of just the vocabulary of the time and the way that things sort of worked. At one point, there's a line about a noise such as a man might make involuntarily feeling the nail go through his hand into the wood. I don't know. I think Hemingway is a pretty skillful writer. And if he was going to go for some sort of Christ-like allegory, I feel like he would be a little more subtle about it than that, because that's kind of a conk you over the head type of a line right there. So I feel like maybe you're right. And it is more that's just another sort of, you know, a comparison that you can make to elicit a response or a feeling from the reader.
Well, you do mention the overall sort of philosophy of the book, and I do think that there is a sort of a meditation on the necessity of suffering, or at least on the way that being a man necessitates bearing suffering with dignity and without complaint. And I think that that runs through a lot of Hemingway's work. I think that while Santiago spends a lot of time wondering about the ultimate morality of what he's doing, the one thing that he comes back to again and again is the idea that struggle and suffering, both on his part and on the fish's part, somehow elevate their existence, that's kind of the important thing about their existence. That's what they are meant to do, and that's what, and by doing that, by meeting the suffering, by meeting death, by meeting both the death of the animal and looking into his own death, that is him fulfilling his role as a man. And I guess that in some ways that relates to Christ in the sort of the idea that there is redemption in suffering. But there's just a little tagline here at the end. The boy, his apprentice finds him the next day, and ministers to him, talks to him about what happened, and runs off to get him some food, some coffee, some nourishment, and all of the other fishermen and workers in the harbor are amazed to see the fish skeleton. And the implication is that his luck may be changing, because at least people are treating him with a certain amount of respect and deference when they see the size of the fish. And the boy says that it doesn't matter what his parents says, he's going to go out with them the next time. And the man already has some thoughts about how to make the next time better, and about how he's going to make sure that they have plenty of killing harpoons on hand so that they don't have to rely on knives anymore. There's a little dig at the end where a couple of tourists are coming through town, and they see the marlin's tail sticking out of the garbage and ask what it is, and the locals are trying to explain that sharks ate it. But all they understand is the word shark, and they think that they're saying that this tail belonged to a shark, and they say, oh, I didn't know sharks had such pretty tails. Which is, it's kind of funny coming at this point. So, I mean, it literally comes in maybe the last two paragraphs of the book. And it seems like Hemingway making some sort of a comment on the privileged life of American tourists or something, but...
Yeah, it felt like a really sharp left turn from the rest of the introspection of the book and the man and the elements and his thoughts and his philosophy. And then suddenly we get something that is just so completely different in feel and tone. And I don't know, I feel like if I had been his editor, I would have said, maybe ditch that. It felt very, very off to me as a reader.
Well, you know, there's a short story that Hemingway wrote called The Light of the World, which is about two guys going out drinking and going into a brothel and talking to the prostitutes there. And it starts with one tone, and then when they start talking to the prostitutes, it just becomes ridiculous and silly and funny and hilarious in a way that Hemingway never seems hilarious. And it sort of comes out of nowhere, and it's one of my favorite stories he ever wrote, because it's so very formless. You know, you think you know what Hemingway is on about, and then he writes something like that. Maybe if he'd had a little bit more time left over in the book, he might have gone somewhere with this, but it does end with Santiago going back and dreaming about his lions again. And so we're left with this, Santiago, maybe he's on the mend. Maybe he'll have better luck now. Or maybe this was his last hurrah. But that's how we end the book.
First of all, I would just want to say that I'm laughing at myself a little bit for suggesting that I should or could edit Hemingway. That was not what I meant. But yeah, I think I enjoyed the opportunity to read this again because, as I said, I think I liked it better than I expected to, and then it helped me remember that I had liked it even better the first time than I had thought I had. One of my many jobs that I've had over the years was as a technical writer. So, you know, the concept of minimalism in writing is sort of close to my heart. So there's a part of me that after reading this again wants to go back in time and do two different things. I want to, first of all, explain to my high school self that not only is this, you know, sort of inoffensive, but it can be a very good thing, because that is something that in my own writing as a youngster, I certainly did not know. And then I also want to go back to my tech writer and editor self and like use this as a textbook for all of my coworkers, many of whom struggled very much with the concept of, short sentences, short words. Because I think a lot of times people lose touch with the fact that that's not necessarily a bad thing. This book is full of simple prose, but that doesn't make it necessarily any less beautiful. I think this book is achingly and hauntingly beautiful at times. You get sentences like, one of my favorites was, he looked ahead and saw a flight of wild ducks etching themselves against the sky over the water, then blurring, then etching again, and he knew no man was ever alone on the sea. I mean, that sentence is, I mean, it's more complex than many of the sentences in the book, but I think that it sort of stands out all the more because of that. You know, Hemingway is not incapable of creating more complex sentences. I think he just uses it sparingly, and then they hit you in the face a little bit more strongly when they are in there, so it flows, and I think that in that sort of stark way that it's a very beautiful book.
To talk about style here, let's look at the opening of the book.
He was an old man who fished alone in a skiff in the Gulf Stream, and he had gone 84 days now without taking a fish. In the first 40 days, a boy had been with him, but after 40 days without a fish, the boy's parents told him that the old man was now definitely and finally solero, which is the worst form of enmity. And the boy had gone at their orders in another boat which caught 3 good fish the first week. It had made the boy sad to see the old man come in each day with his skiff empty, and he always went down to help him carry either the coiled lines or the gaff and harpoon and the sail that was furled around the mast. The sail was patched with flour sacks, and furled, it looked like the flag of permanent defeat.
There is a fancy schmancy word for this that I learned back in my graduate school days, which is called parataxis. It means when you have sentences that are all joined together by "and." He was an old man who fished alone in a skiff in the Gulf Stream, and he had gone 84 days now without taking a fish. There's never because, there's never therefore. That is what's called hypotaxis, when you take one part of a sentence, one phrase of a sentence, and make it logically dependent on another one. Everything in Hemingway is all on a same even level, going and, maybe sometimes it says but. It is the sort of thing that people glom on all the time when they want to write parodies of him.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, as you say, actually quite lovely and quite beautiful. It's very sonorous and very hypnotic, and it is, I think, particularly appropriate for a story about being at sea for so long.
I completely agree. It did feel like, you know, in a small way, you're put into that boat with him because you're just sort of rolling along over the waves. And I also found that it was interesting how, you know, the old man speaks out loud quite a bit. So you get a lot of him talking to himself or to the fish or to the birds or the turtles or whatever. But I also found it was interesting how there's no use of any kind of punctuation for when he's thinking, because he also does an awful lot of thinking. And, you know, so there's no quotes. That's used for words spoken aloud, but also no italics. And then I realized that I think is maybe more of a modern thing, because I didn't really realize that it had become so common until I started missing it in this story, because so many of the books that I've read lately have had usually italics for when a person is thinking something to themselves than rather than speaking out loud.
Well, and, yeah. The italics as internal monologue, it's interesting you bring that up, because that is something that it was sort of it was largely innovated by Faulkner, who is a contemporary of Hemingway, and the three great men of modernism in American literature in the 30s were Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and Faulkner. And it's interesting that the three of them were writing at the same time because they went in such different directions. Faulkner was also, of course, completely interested in stream of consciousness, but Faulkner's sentences are crazily complex. And actually, when Faulkner originally wrote, his plan for The Sound of the Fury was that he wanted to have sections written in different color ink. That was how he was going to make the break between things that were thought and things that were spoken aloud, or things that happened in the past and the future. But his editor would not pay for that, so he ended up falling back on italics. And it's funny because if you go back and read, say, The Sound of the Fury, you'll see how much modern literature gets that whole thing from that one book.
I remember actually I read The Sound of the Fury just for fun, not for a class, although in the end I didn't really think it was all that fun. But but yes, now that you mentioned that, that is very much something that must have been picked up from there.
If Faulkner was interested in in sort of internal monologue and these very complex tortuous thoughts, Fitzgerald, when you think of Fitzgerald, you tend to think of very elegant, clever, melodic turns of sentence and very jazzy writing. And of course, Hemingway was nothing like either of those. He's just very strong, very slow, very simple. Some people would see it as almost kind of plodding, but of course, for Hemingway, it was all highly masculine, which is funny to me because I think he got it again ultimately from Gertrude Stein.
But he certainly made it feel as masculine as he could, and perhaps that's just by the topics and the choice of words even in some places. I mean, as a woman reading this, I found myself kind of yanked out of the story a good number of times because I found it off-putting. At the beginning where he's talking about the sea being La Mar instead of El Mar, meaning it's feminine, and saying how the moon affects her as it does a woman. If she did wilder, wicked things, it was because she could not help them. And that's the kind of thing that makes me want to throw a book across the room. Yeah, we can't help it. Yes, we just go crazy. And even when he's talking about the fish itself, taking the bait like a male, pulling like a male, his fight having no panic in it because, if it's a female fish, it's going to be wild and panic stricken and, a despairing fight that soon exhausts her. And I wonder if, maybe that is the way female marlins react as opposed to male marlins. But based on a lot of the other stuff that I keep reading, that I keep seeing him, the way he phrases things, makes me wonder if that's just sort of him projecting onto fish what he sees in human women. I'm not really sure. But you mentioned earlier just talking about the philosophy of the book being what a man can endure. We get so much of that. I will show him that direct quote from the book. I will show him what a man can do and what a man endures. And none of the times that he says a man in this book does it have the flavor of the word mankind. I really get the sense that, man versus woman as opposed to man meaning all of us.
Sure. And of course, his preoccupation with sports.
Yes, the great DiMaggio.
What makes Joe DiMaggio a memorable sports figure, and I had to look this up because I'm not really a sports fan myself, but what makes him a memorable sports figure is the fact that he had the longest unbroken streak of games that he got a hit in, which is something like, I don't know, 57 games or something like that, which is unheard of, and no one has even come close. And so we have the contrast between his hero, who seems to have unlimited luck, and the man who has no luck. But both of them are the same in that each time they go out again and they try again, and the past makes no difference. It's just what they are doing at the moment that matters, we're told.
Yes, each time was a new time, and he never thought about the past when he was doing it.
I don't want to push you any further with this if you don't want to go anything, but I am curious as to reading this, the experience of reading this as a woman. Do you have any other thoughts about that? Because Hemingway really did want to present himself as a man's man. I mean, he was a big game hunter himself, and his books were all about men having man problems.
There's a lot of man pain in his books. That is for sure. For me personally, reading it, like I said, there were moments where it pulled me out of the story, and I think that's my biggest problem with it. That when you're writing from a perspective that is that myopic, and doesn't leave room for anyone else, it's sometimes you're going to push people away. But you know, that's not always a bad thing, because you know it's good to choose a perspective and really get into the head of a character. It did take me out of it from time to time, but my reaction was not so much to get angry as to sort of just roll my eyes and just kind of shake my head at it. So I mean, this is never ever going to top my list of favorite books, because I have a tendency personally to choose books that I will read and reread based on how much I like the characters. If there are characters that I would want to hang out with, or characters I'd want to be or emulate, and I get none of those things from Santiago. And a good part of that is the overall theme of the book, that yes, this is about a manly man doing his sea hunting thing, and everything. I mean, everything is told from the perspective of this character, which is a neat trick. I mean, that's a neat thing. Even when he's talking about the airplane that he sees flying overhead at one point, he describes it as being 200 fathoms up, which is not the kind of thing that you think of. So, I mean, it's not only just the maleness versus the male versus nature that we're getting from him, but it's really the viewpoint of a fisherman. So I guess it makes it a little bit easier for me to take all of this testosterone, because it really is just coming from this one character. The character is the book when it comes right down to it, and that is the character. He's a well-drawn character. Probably the one thing that I did understand about Santiago as a character, and the one place that I could identify with him, was at the end where he just says, "Bed is my friend, just bed." Because, I mean, who hasn't felt like that? So at least we've got something to pull us together, Santiago and me.
I'd like to thank my co-host, Erica Ensign. You can find her in a lot of places. On the podcasts, The Incomparable, Total Party Kill, and Lazy Doctor Who, all at theincomparable.com. Or on her own Doctor Who podcast, Verity, at veritypodcast.com. She has a Babylon 5 podcast at b5audioguide.com. She also produces a fiction podcast for The Uncanny Magazine at uncannymagazine.com. And if you want to follow her on Twitter, you can do so at HollyGoDarkly. I'd like to thank Jason Altrop for reading the excerpt. The Old Man and the Sea is copyright 1952, Ernest Hemingway. For next time, I don't know what we're reading, so take this opportunity to review your notes. There's going to be a final one of these days, and everything will be on it.